Welcome, everyone. I'm very pleased to welcome you all to an afternoon on the West Coast or an evening on the East Coast with Joseph Goldstein, one of the three founders of the Insight Meditation Community in the United States back in the 1970s. Welcome to those who are here in the meditation hall in person and to all of you on Zoom. We have a full house today. Thank you so much for joining us for this benefit event, which Joseph has generously offered to Seattle Insight. We've been looking forward to this afternoon for almost a year now with a lot of anticipation. My name is Lauren Wilson, and I'm co-hosting with Steve Wilhelm on Zoom and Carrie Peterson, one of our senior teachers. Carrie will be introducing Joseph in more depth in a moment.
Thank you, Lauren, and welcome, everybody. As Lauren said, my name is Carrie Peterson. I'm one of the teachers here, and I have the great honor and privilege of welcoming and introducing Joseph Goldstein today. So we have a group here in the hall, as Lauren mentioned, and a large group online to welcome one of our most revered and esteemed teachers, and indeed one of the true pioneers and founders of this Western Insight Meditation movement. And before I read a little bit about Joseph's bio, Joseph used to come regularly to Seattle to see us in person in the pre-COVID era. So many of us had the advantage and the good fortune of sitting regularly with Joseph on his trips to Seattle and his teachings when he was here in the Northwest. So many of us have fond memories from that time. Joseph Goldstein has been leading insight and loving kindness meditation retreats worldwide since 1974. He's, as Lauren mentioned, he's a co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, where he's now on the Guiding Teachers Founders Council. So in 1989, together with several other teachers and students of Insight Meditation, he helped establish the Barre Center for Buddhist Studies. Joseph first became interested in Buddhism as a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand in 1965, and since 1967 has studied and practiced different forms of Buddhist meditation under teachers from India, Burma, and Tibet. He is the author of Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Awakening, A Heart Full of Peace, One Dharma, The Emerging Western Buddhism, Insight Meditation, The Practice of Freedom, The Experience of Insight, and co-author of Seeking the Heart of Wisdom and Insight Meditation, A Correspondence Course. And I think also, this wasn't on the official bio, but I think also he's published his first book of poetry called Dreamscapes, which it's my understanding that through the IMS website, you can purchase this and the proceeds go to support scholarships for people coming on retreat. So we're very, very fortunate and grateful that Joseph is willing to spend his time and energy speaking with us tonight. And as Lauren mentioned, this will be an interactive night, so evening, afternoon. So one of the things I've most appreciated about the many places that Joseph's teachings have appeared lately is that they're often in conversation. So hopefully tonight will be a kind of conversational dharma. So as Lauren also mentioned, we will sit together. We'll sit together for a half an hour, and then we'll have a short bio break, and then we'll hand it over to Joseph. Okay, so welcome, everybody. Welcome. Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you. So it's really good to be here with you all. So as we begin sitting, just for half an hour, there's just one frame I'd like to offer. Some of you may be familiar with it, others not. There is a line in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, that says, be mindful, and then in the equivalent of quotation marks in Pali, be mindful, quote, there is a body, unquote. And then it goes on from there. But that phrase, there is a body, when I first came across that in reading the text, and it was pointed out by Venerable Inalio that it had this meaning, because it's in quotations, it's almost like having a very soft mental note or label, there is a body. And in experimenting with that, in beginning one sitting, for myself and now many people that I've suggested it to use that phrase, there is a body, as the frame for sitting, there is a body, so we're feeling the whole body, and then becoming aware of the breath within that larger frame. So that instead of necessarily zooming into the breath and narrowing the attention on the breath, an alternative to that would be to start with this phrase, there is a body, feeling the whole body, and then becoming aware of the breath within that space without necessarily immediately narrowing the attention onto the breath. So does this seem clear? People generally have found it very helpful because it's not uncommon when we're focusing very precisely on the breath that very often there's some level of control, sometimes very obvious and sometimes quite subtle. But in using this larger frame, there's a body, we're stabilizing the attention within a whole body awareness, and that allows the breath to come and go on its own because we're not narrowing the attention on it. And so for many people, they found it a much more relaxing and open way to be with the breath. And then when one feels just intuitively to narrow it, you know, more precisely to the breath and then open. So you can play with this if this particular approach is of interest. So mostly we'll sit in silence. I may drop in a few reminders during the sit. But you're all experienced and you know what to do. So we'll sit for about half an hour now. There is a body settling into that full body awareness and feeling the breath within it. within the frame there is a body, be aware of any predominant sensations that appear. And notice their changing nature. Subtle changes, an obvious change. and be mindful of any thoughts or images as they appear in the mind. Notice what happens to them as you become mindful of them.
So why don't we take about 5 minutes, and if you'd like to stand up and bring some ease to the body, I'll ring a bell in 5 or 6 minutes and we'll return. Okay, so welcome back, everybody. And I know several people joined during the break and during the guided sit. So this portion of the evening, thank you again for your generosity. Joseph will be devoted to questions and responses. So rather than questions and answers, we'll call it questions and responses. And we'll go back and forth between folks asking here in the room and online with Steve. But I thought just to get us started, and maybe as people are getting their courage and questions together, I thought maybe I could start with a question just to get us started. So I've noticed that in conversations and listening to you in conversations lately being maybe the last 5 years or so, but after 50 years of teaching and practice, in particular lately, in talking about the goal of practice or where our practice path points, there seems to be a lot more willingness to talk about awakening and nibbana and how we conceptualize that or think about that or frame that. And I heard you recently talk about enlightenment as lightening up, lightening up. And I particularly liked that. And I could feel it in your voice and in your just being as you were talking about it, and I felt vicarious relief. And I wonder if you could just speak a little bit to how has your maybe expression or the way you talk about the deepest goal of practice, has that changed over the 50 years, or anything you'd like to say about how you're holding that now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do like that definition of enlightenment, lightening up, because I've really noticed that happening in my own life, you know, after all these years of practice. And I think basically it's a reflection of increasing understandings of selflessness, of non-self. You know, and so we start taking ourselves less seriously because we're not so bound up in this concept of self. And that brings a lot of joy and also a lot of relaxation. And I've noticed this in my teaching. I feel much freer in expressing the Dharma. It's more playful, you know, even as we may be talking about some really profound things. So another kind of shift that's happened over these many years. So for a long time, you know, enlightenment or nibbana, there was a kind of, I would say, an unhealthy striving. You know, to have it as an aspiration and to be heading in that direction is, of course, the whole point of the path. You know, there is an end point and a goal. But if there's that kind of unhealthy striving and wanting and almost like a greed for it, it just creates more tension. And, you know, over these years of practice, and especially in recent years, I've come to appreciate more that it's not about getting, it's about letting go. You know, so it's not reaching out for something. It's a settling back and letting go into basically into non-clinging. You know, so it's a stopping of clinging rather than a grasping for something. And if we can really begin to internalize that, it does create more relaxation in our practice. But one frame that I think is really helpful in talking about relaxation, which is really an important part, both of deepening concentration and as a foundation for letting go, not holding on. And when I'm teaching, you know, in person, I will often say, be relaxed, but not casual. You know, and by casual, I mean when we're going along being more or less mindful, where we're kind of there, but not completely there. You know, and so we don't want to fall into that more or less mindfulness place. We want to be relaxed and not casual about it. So all of these things really is what's been developing over these last years. And practice gets a lot more fun, even when it's difficult.
That's very good news. Thank you. Thank you. So now I'd really like to open it up. So we thought the best way to do this so that people could be seen and heard most clearly by Joseph, hopefully without this being too intimidating, would be those in the room, if you'd like to raise a hand, I'll just invite you to come up here so it can really feel more like a conversation. And then we'll go back and forth. So then Steve will help people who have hands raised online be seen and heard also. So please would just open it up now if you have a question. Seems like there's somebody in the chat, Steve, and then someone raising a hand. Is it Brandith?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Good, okay. I think this relates maybe to Catherine's question too. I have a question about joy, Joseph. Thank you for your time here with us, and also thank you for teaching me to meditate in the spring of 1973 in India when I was 20 years old. Quite a different path due to that. But my question is about joy. Many of the Buddhists that I know, there seems to be almost like a doer quality there sometimes, like, you know, this is so difficult. I'm trying to follow all these rules. I feel guilty all the time. I don't, you know, it's kind of like, and then I think with some of my Vedic friends, there seems to be often a more joyous quality. Like, yes, I made a mistake. I didn't murder anyone, but I'd made a mistake, and I'm what a wonderful opportunity to learn something. You know, I'm grateful for that opportunity, and I learned this, and now I'm moving on, and there's more light and more joyfulness sometimes in my experience in this group. And I feel like Catherine, I think it's Catherine, but she kind of said it too. What do you think about that? How do we approach that? I liked your idea of more relaxation and more not being casual, but being more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For me, a big part of my own practice in watching my mind,
mm-hmm.
Is having a sense of humor about it. A sense of humor is really helpful, even as one sees the craziness. You know, all the neurotic patterns and tendencies and all the things you mentioned. You know, we feel guilty or whatever it is that's happening. So I'd like to encourage people to smile at their own minds, you know, and that lightens everything up. That's part of the lightening up aspect. So that's one, I think, important piece, a sense of humor about oneself, you know. A few particular qualities that we can cultivate that bring about a more heartful space, you know, and a more joyful space. One is, and this is its own reflection, is really the quality of gratitude. And this came, it really struck home for me. It was a few years ago, and I was dealing with not a serious health issue, but something that needed attending to. And it was confusing what to do. And so my mind was just caught up in this kind of confused obsessiveness about this situation. You know, and I noticed that, but it was really, felt very compelling. But I could sense myself getting tight around it, you know, because I didn't know what the right path forward would be. I knew I had to do something. And it was really taking over my mind. And then just quite spontaneously, you know, in one moment, for whatever reason, my mind just went to the gratitude channel. You know, I started reflecting on all the great things in my life. You know, there's so many blessings in my life. And it was amazing in that moment. It was instantaneous. In that moment of just opening up to the gratitude for all the good things, everything lightened. And the issue was still there, but it was a small piece in a much larger heart space, mind space, rather than the large piece in it all. Mm-hmm. You know? And so that lightened everything up tremendously. And I'm a big fan of gratitude. As so often, sometimes just in the course of a day, I'll just kind of put out to the universe, thank you for the blessings in my life. You know, and it's a reminder, and it's a joyful quality. And of course, something I'm sure you're familiar with is, you know, the practice of the Brahma Viharas, of metta and compassion. And yeah. So the one for me that when I was practicing it intensively, the one that brought the most joy, and for some strange reason, people often find it the most difficult of the four, is mudita, that empathetic joy, mm-hmm. where we're taking happiness in the happiness of others. Mm-hmm. So I'll just give one story about that. Years ago, when I was going to Burma to practice, and just a friend of mine had been there for a few years already when I went. You know, I went for a few months. And he was there, and after a few years in the monastery, he was like, he was floating. He was so calm. And my first kind of respond, I could feel in myself a kind of comparing mind. You know, oh, well, he's really in a great space, and I'm whatever I was up to. And then I saw that, you know, I saw what my mind was doing. So I started doing mudita. I started doing empathetic joy. You know, may your happiness increase. May your practice deepen. And I found, first, it's a delightful mind state, you know, to have that happiness for the happiness of others. And when I was doing the Brahma Viharas intensively, you know, one period in my practice, so several months at a time, you know, practicing each of these, I felt that practicing mudita was like eating ice cream. It was just so, it was so uplifting and so joyful, more than the others. It was just, so it's all of these things. You know, it's gratitude. It's the Brahma Viharas in general, but this empathetic joy in particular, and having a sense of humor about one's mind. So I recommend all of these. And they're not difficult to do. I mean, you know, one doesn't have to be a super yogi to
practice. Right. We have these very active minds, and so they like to chatter in there, you know?
Yeah, but this is the practice, being aware of that.
Exactly.
You know, and then dropping into a more skillful space. Yeah. But each of the things I mentioned doesn't require one to be a super meditator or in deep concentration. They're just cultivating those very ordinary everyday qualities, but remembering to do it instead of just being carried away by the patterns of our conditioning.
Sometimes I just say, well, thank you very much, mind, and now I'm going to ignore you.
Yeah,
I know you're trying to keep me safe, but yeah. I'm going to ignore you.
Yeah. I mean, everybody can find their own little what's the word, hacks, you know, to remind one. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
So have fun.
I do. Thank you.
Okay, we don't have any takers in the room yet. Oh, there's one. So how about, do you want to come up? And then... I think it's Lisa online. Yes, you can use this one. Thank you.
Hi, Joseph.
Hi.
It's a real honor to be talking to you, and thank you for all your talks. The Path of Insight on the Waking Up app has been very helpful, and your conversations with Sam. One of the
I hope they've been helpful.
One of your talks, you talk about the practice of renunciation, and I get stuck with renunciation and sort of not wanting renunciation, or wanting and not wanting to renunciate. So can you talk a little bit about that, please?
So I found that the problem in relating to that is the word. You know, renunciation, it's, oh no, you know, it feels like a downer. Yeah. However, if you just change the word in terms of what it's pointing to, so what I found really helpful is to understand that mind state as non-addiction. Because when I think of non-addiction, that phrase, to me, it implies freedom. You know, we're not being addicted to something. And so we're letting go into a more open, spacious place. But if we use the word renunciation, it's like, oh, I have to give something up. But it's actually the same mind state, but we have a different relationship to it because of the connotation of the word. Right? So of all the paramis, you know, the ten paramis, I wouldn't say that renunciation is my strong suit. So I have worked with it, you know, in different ways, a lot. And again, one can bring a sense of humor to it. So I'll just share two little stories. So when I'm on retreat, you know, I have my routine, get up in the morning, first thing, have a cup of coffee, you know, to get me going. So this one year I was on retreat, went downstairs to the kitchen, put the coffee beans in the grinder, and the grinder was broken. And the first thought in my mind, the very first thought, disaster. And that's what I actually felt. This is a disaster. But like 3 seconds later, I just started laughing at my mind, you know, that it could give such importance. And really, it was okay, so renounce the coffee for the morning, right? But to see our mind in relationship to what we're holding on, you know, holding on to, and often seeing how ridiculous it is, right? So again, I think the change of language of, yeah, I don't want to be addicted to things. So that actually inspires me a bit, you know, to practice the letting go. And for those who find it difficult for whatever reason, that renunciation is not an easy thing to do, I would suggest really in the course of a day, just looking for little things, you know, that maybe, I don't know, maybe we're about to have the second piece of cake, right? No, I don't need it. Yeah. So just little things to practice, to strengthen that muscle of non-addiction, you know, of, oh, I can let this go. And what I found is if I practice with these little things in the day, I get more familiar, I get more easeful. It's like that neural pathway gets strengthened, the ability. No, I don't need to do this. And it can be done in a really gentle way. Just like I said, no, I think I'll pass. No, I don't need to do this. You know, so it doesn't have to be a tight kind of practice or a struggle. And I would start with small things, you know, so we learn how to do it. There's a story from the Buddha's time where he's talking about, I think this is in the Buddhist literature someplace, so I don't know if he was talking about his own past life or somebody, he was giving it as a teaching, but for people who had a hard time letting go of renouncing, he just suggested holding a stone in one hand and then putting it in the other. So letting this hand is letting go, goes to the other. Then this hand is let, so it can go, it can get pretty basic. Yeah. You know, so for those who have problem with renunciation, start with a couple of stones.
Thank you. Maybe I'll start with something other than coffee. That one's hard.
I understand. There was disaster. Right, especially in Seattle, giving up coffee. Oh boy, that's doubly hard.
It's woven in. It's part of the part of the city.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. So Lisa, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Joseph, for being here, and I'm really glad that I'm able to be here. And so this question. Maybe has two parts, but I wanted to first ask you if you think there are times when it actually isn't beneficial to do Vipassana practice. And the context I want to give you is, if someone suffers from a serious mental illness, I suffer from bipolar disorder, and I experience very severe periods of very severe bipolar depression that lasts about 4 months at a time. And I can't do Vipassana practice during that time. And I don't, it feels like not the right thing to do, but I'm not sure. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about that, and if you have any recommendations of what kind of practice might be more helpful during those periods of time.
Mm-hmm. I think there are definitely times, for whatever reason, and for different people, it might be different situations, you know, or different conditions. Basically, when it's just not working, you know, and that making more effort seems to be making things worse, you know, and getting tighter or more frustrated or whatever. And this, I'm not talking about the usual meditative hindrances. You know, I'm talking about like the situation you're describing. So I think it would be interesting, just a couple of things come to mind. One is, have you experimented with doing the loving kindness meditation at that time?
I have not.
Well, that I think would be a really, really good thing to do. And it would be interesting. It could be either loving kindness or compassion, and the techniques are slightly different, although they're related. But I would experiment with actually doing quite a bit of it for yourself.
Okay.
You know, may I be happy. May I be at peace. May I be free of fear of pain, whatever words really speak to you. So it's not just mechanical. You're really expressing a wish for what you feel would be most helpful and beneficial to you.
Okay.
You know, and so it's really, and sitting for however long, you know, it feels useful. And it's like a mantra of loving kindness.
Okay.
You know, where you're really focusing on the words. The other thing that comes to mind, and again, I don't know whether you've tried this or not, but really emphasizing the walking rather than the sitting. Have you tried the walking meditation?
I don't, because I actually spend most of that time. I actually have to be in bed. I'm weak and I'm have extreme fatigue, and so I'm mostly looking for stuff I can do while I'm lying in bed.
Right. Well, then the metta, you know, the loving kindness, obviously would work. I just wonder though. This might not be helpful at all. It's just something that's coming to mind. I'm just wondering, at that time when you're feeling weak, you know, if it would be possible, even for short, like for 5 minutes, mm-hmm. or 10 minutes, just to do some walking in a relaxed way, and just almost in the same way that I mentioned for the sitting, instead of zeroing in on the breath, to have a larger frame. So in the walking, to just feel the whole body moving. So it's as stressless as possible. You know, you're not efforting at all. You're just walking and feeling the body moving. And as I say, even for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, it would be interesting to see if that actually brings some energy.
Okay.
You know, and it would be an experiment.
Yeah, it sounds actually like a good experiment. But the loving kindness meditation and compassion meditation, like just right now, listening to you, I can see how that could be really hopeful because one of the things that happens is I get angry at my body. I get angry at my body. I get angry at my brain. I get angry at the situation. Like it's difficult to accept being in that, right. Having my mind be in that space.
Right. Okay. So I have to, since you mentioned that in particular, I have to share with you, we had, a Sri Lankan monk, one of the older, very venerable monks. His name was Ananta Maitreya, the great monk. Well, he visited IMS once, and he led a metta meditation in a way that I had never heard before. But you reminded me just now. So the way he taught metta was, may my head be happy and healthy. May my shoulders be happy and healthy. And he went through the whole body like that. You know, I had never heard metta being done like that. But it was really sweet. You know, and the way we're relating to anything, in this case, the body, but it's true of how we're relating to anything at all, that can be trained. It's not set in stone. So even though there may be a pattern of a lot of judgment and ill will towards it and all of that, we don't have to be stuck in that pattern. It can be replaced with a more skillful one, like the metta in general. But you might try it in relationship, you know, part by part in your body and see if it softens. Almost like, you know, a mother might be with a child, you know, who's ill. You know, that quality. So I think there's a lot of potential, actually, for finding that space of greater ease.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, looks like we have a few hands online. So is that Margot?
Thank you very much. And wonderful to see you, Joseph, and thank you so much for being with us here today. Given what you said earlier about the empty nature of self and not taking oneself so seriously, I'm just wondering if you might like to elaborate in terms of such serious times. So on one hand, of course, I'm practicing, and I practice as much as possible throughout life. And at the same time, I'm acutely aware of what's going on almost everywhere globally. And so I have a good self-care plan. And, you know, I'm a therapist, so I have lots of things to work with along with, you know, meditative techniques. But it does seem like it's a particularly acute time.
This question comes up a lot because the world is going nuts. You know, terrible things, you know, are happening. And I found for myself and also in sharing with people that there are two qualities which really help to be with the situation in a skillful way, you know. So the first of them is something which we develop in the practice, and that is equanimity. You know, so equanimity is open to what's happening. It's not closing off to it, but it's learning how to be less reactive, you know, so that there's some space where we can simply see clearly what it is that's happening. And I found a couple of ways that can pretty immediately arouse equanimity some degree of equanimity in the midst of everything that's going on. So two in particular, and they both have to do with enlarging one's perspective. So one is kind of a going outside at night and just looking at the stars. Or now, especially with the, you know, the moon journey and all those fantastic pictures from space and from the other side of the moon and looking at the planet from there. It just helps us realize that, yeah, everything that's going on here, it's so small in the context of this vast universe, you know, but we're so caught in the immediacy, you know, of our own lives and what's happening on the planet. And I find that just opening to the vastness of the cosmos really helps the mind just settle back a bit, you know, and open and less immediately reactive to what's going on. I don't know if you're familiar. There's a famous short essay by Carl Sagan, the, you know, astronomer. It's called The Blue Dot. And he just talks about how everything in our lives is just happening on this tiny blue dot in the cosmos. But he goes on and on. The essay is quite beautiful. So you might look at that. The other thing that really brings some equanimity for me, I love to read history. That's kind of, I think, my favorite reading genre. All kinds, you know, any kind of history. And what I get from that is the understanding that what's happening now has always been going on. There's nothing new, you know. There was one book I read which was really helpful. It was called The Fall of Civilizations, and by Paul Cooper. And he just tracked civilizations all around the globe, you know, from China and India and Europe and the Middle East and the Americas. And he traced the arising and flourishing and decline of civilizations. And it was so interesting. And also describing the conditions for the decline. And it was just so interesting to remember that the law of change, the law of arising and passing, is not only moment to moment, it's on a civilization level as well, you know. And so it's inevitable. These things are inevitable, and it's happened throughout the centuries in every civilization. So just in reading that, again, it just provides some perspective, you know, to hold it with greater equanimity. Okay, that's the first quality. The second quality that's just as essential is compassion for the suffering that's actually going on. You know, so we can have this very big perspective, and still we're living on this planet, in this society, in this culture, and there's a lot of suffering. And so we want to be open to that. And compassion arises when we're willing to be open to it. You know, when we're not defending ourselves against it. And in compassion, my favorite mantra of compassion was the title of a book. It was the title of a book by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman. The title was, How Can I Help? And I love that. It's just such a simple, It's such a simple framework. And it can really become, I find that it can become the grounding in our life. You know, just to have that energy or that wish or that motivation. And it could be with big things. It could be just day to day, you know, with people we meet. Well, how can I help? Where that becomes the motivating principle, you know, of how we're living in the world. And sometimes there are things we can do and we can't help. And sometimes there aren't. Sometimes there's nothing we can do. And that's where equanimity comes into play. So I think these two in balance, equanimity and compassion, really provide the framework for engaging with what's happening now.
Yes, thank you very much. I feel like I'm working all of what you've said to varying degrees at varying times. Yeah. And also, one time one of my sisters said, I thought you were a Buddhist. And I said, well, I said, there's fierce compassion also, thinking of Joanna Macy. But I guess fundamentally having to be with powerlessness is, you know, also a variable to the mix. And I'm aware of that also. But I'm doing small things. So, yes, thank you so much.
But it's about that's where the balance of the compassion and equanimity helps. When we realize it's a situation where we don't have any agency, you know, so that instead of getting reactive to that or, you know, creating more suffering for ourselves in that, we just recognize, yeah, there are lots of things that go on, not only in the world, you know, when, you know, we have some illness and there's not a clear path through it, right? Where we don't have control over a lot of things. And so equanimity, and in the Buddhist teachings, as you know, it's one of the factors of enlightenment. It's a really important quality to develop. And as I say, balancing it with the compassion, so then it just provides a spectrum of response.
Yes, thank you so much for illuminating that very challenging space.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, looks like Barbara and Stephen.
See, can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, first, thank you, Joseph, and thank you, Seattle Insight. We're sitting over here on Bainbridge Island and just could sit on our own couch and participate in what you're doing today. It's wonderful. Joseph, I know it has to have been a few years ago, maybe several, where I was listening to Joseph Goldstein at Buddha at the Gas Pump. And I loved that whole talk. And you told a story that I've been trying to track down since, everything short of emailing you, about some, I'm bringing it back to abstinence and renunciation. Because you told a story that I loved and I would like to be able to learn it as a story to tell. I'm involved in refuge recovery, where some visitors are at a monastery and the monk is telling, or the abbot is telling how things work. And I'm quite sure this is where I heard this story. And then the people say, oh, but it must be so hard. They have to abstain from this and that and this and that. And the abbot says, oh, no, they don't have to. they want to in the process. Do you remember this story? Is this one that you're familiar with?
Well, it's not, but it's a great story.
It is. I swear you, I got the transcript of it and I couldn't find that story in there. So I don't know, but the gist of it is, oh no, you know, they don't have to, but as they do, they're fine. It's so rewarding that they begin to think it's, you know, it's a great pleasure, you know.
Yes.
That's the gist of the story. Okay, well.
Well, it is a great story. It's the first time I'm hearing it, and I may use it.
I've attributed it to you for several years now. Thank you. We love your mindfulness book. We're rereading it every morning, little pieces of it.
Oh, great.
It's the best text. I think I'll read it until I die. Yeah, thank you all.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Let's see, I guess, how do I mute myself?
Okay, so we have time for a few more here.
Where are people on site?
Good question.
Come on, guys.
So yes, please come. A little intimidated, perhaps, by this setup. I'm sorry. Coming up, I know. Yes, let's use this one. Thank you. Let's turn this on here.
Hi. The question I wanted to ask is on how you work with a worrying mind. I feel like when I sit down to meditate and I've just been in the state of just like worrying about things or planning what I want to do in my life, I think I can just sit there and just rehash and just keep doing that endlessly. So I'm just curious on how to work with that better.
Okay, so first tell me, when you sit, what practice do you do? What are you actually attempting to do when you sit?
I think generally I start with trying to focus on my breath and get myself to just feel my body. And then I've tried kind of just going through from like the top of my head to the bottom, doing body scans. And I've also just tried I don't know the best way to describe it, but just awareness, just like generally, not on anything specific.
Right. So generally, I would say to focus on something specific. Because really what's needed, and I think what you're asking about is very common.
Yeah.
You have to, and if it's not worry, it's other kind of thoughts, you know, where it's just easy. You're sitting and nobody's bothering you and you have time to, the mind thinks, oh, this is great. You have a chance to just think about everything. So the antidote to that is just strengthening to some degree that quality of concentration. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's really important. The words we use to describe different things very often have an effect on what we're trying to do. So just as an example, the word concentration, I think, can cause more trouble than help, because for many people, the connotation of concentration is, okay, I have to make an effort and really just focus down on whatever it is, the breath or the body scan. The word I like better, when we're practicing that quality, the word I like better to remind myself of what I'm actually trying to do is steadiness. So when I'm feeling the breath, I'll just remind myself, steady. Just steady. So it's not, I'm not adding a lot of efforting to it. You know, the breath is happening anyway, so there's nothing you have to do to breathe. Right? The breath is happening by itself. So if we can just kind of place the attention there without trying to focus or to trying to hold on or grasp the object. But we're just hanging out there. Okay, steady. Just steady, letting the breath. So it's a much softer approach to developing concentration, to developing one-pointedness. So it's one. Mm-hmm. So it's the attitude. The attitude with which we're doing it really is important, because if there's too much struggle, you know, or striving, that's going to send the mind into that kind of restless thinking about things. So that's one thing. Have you done or have you practiced the loving kindness meditation at all?
Yeah, I've tried it here and there, but I don't think specifically for this.
Well, so when I first went to India, first time to practice, my mind, I studied philosophy at college, my mind loved to think. So I would just sit, and so I'd be sitting there and I'd just be thinking the whole time. And the hour went quickly, and I was enjoying myself. But I wasn't getting any place. I mean, it was... So after some time, I asked my teacher, his name was Munindraji. So I wanted to do the metta as a concentration practice. You know, and I found that for me at that time, just the repetition of the phrases, you know, three or four phrases, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe, something like that. Really simple, both for oneself and others. But I did it. I was doing it intensively. But even if you do it as a daily practice, you know, I found, and metta is a concentration practice, I found that it was easier, because it was mantra-like, because I was repeating the phrases, but it was also developing that quality of metta, of loving kindness. And that was the first time, actually ever, that my mind over time really settled down and became concentrated. So sometimes it's finding the particular right practice that's easier, you know, for the development. But I think it's the development of that steadiness. And over time, kind of the base level of our concentration with practice goes up, you know, so that with practice, then we're operating from a higher level, because we've trained the mind. So again, if you're working with the breath, I would just be really just steady. Just remind yourself very softly, stay steady. And then to experiment with the metta, not just haphazardly. For example, you might take a month, mm-hmm. and that's your practice for the month. You know, and I think that would be enough time to actually see the effect.
Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. There's one other thought that just came to mind. One thing that's really simple, at those times when I have found my mind was just on a thinking jag, for whatever reason, you know, I'd be sitting in meditation and just thinking. I found that if I opened my eyes, just a slit, just slightly open, and sat that way, it was quite amazing to me. To a huge extent, the thought process quieted down. And I think it was for two reasons. One, because the eyes were just slightly open, it was the connection with where I actually was and what I was doing. You know, when the eyes are closed, we can forget that we're meditating. You know, we're just playing with this, whatever our mind is doing. So that connection with the external environment, and also holding the eyes in that position, it's unusual. You know, we don't usually do that, and that takes an intentionality to keep the eyes like that. And the combination of the effort to just keep the eyes slightly open and the connection to the external environment, it would be an interesting experiment to see if that really quiets the thought process. It did for me. It was very dramatic. So all of these things.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you so much. I think steadiness is like a term that I've not really thought about. It's always been like really trying to concentrate, and it's very rigid. So that helps.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah, so just play with these and see which one works the best for you.
Yep, that sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This should probably be our last question, but you go ahead. Thank you.
Is that me? Hello, everyone. Hello. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm wondering if you could say something about your understanding, or the understanding from this Vipassana tradition, about someone who chooses to end their life. And they, for example, someone who had a long-term practitioner who calmly, privately makes a decision as rational and well thought out and discreet and respectful and organized. And how would that be understood within?
Yeah, you know, this question comes up not infrequently. Mm-hmm. And there's not an easy answer to that. Mm-hmm. So, there's no... at least from my perspective, on the one hand, you know, there is the teaching not to take life,
yeah,
including one's own. On the other hand, if one is in really a lot of suffering,
mm-hmm,
you know, and there's no, it doesn't, it's not that there's a remedy for it.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So then the other side is compassion, you know, compassion for the suffering. Somebody once asked a Tibetan teacher just this very question. Mm-hmm. And they said just kind of what I'm saying. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, we would say, you know, don't take life.
Mm-hmm.
From the perspective of compassion, one can understand that. Mm-hmm. So I don't have the magic answer, and everybody needs to kind of really grapple with that question for mm-hmm. themselves. And I think the important thing is just really looking very carefully into one's own mind,
mm-hmm,
to see, I mean, if it's done with a lot of aversion to what's happening,
mm-hmm,
that's probably not a good mind state to go out in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If the mind is peaceful and compassionate,
mm-hmm,
so it's a much more skillful mind.
Mm-hmm.
To go out in. So the circumstances are really important.
Mm-hmm.
And then also exploring on the other side, is there a way I can be with what's happening in a peaceful way?
Yeah.
So it's an investigation, you know, and and it's a challenging question. I feel it in myself, you know, when I imagine different possibilities of the end of life. I thought about all of this, you know, and of course there's no knowing till you're in that situation what actually you'll do. But it requires a thoughtfulness, you know, and to see the whole situation and the quality of one's heart and mind at that time. Yeah, so
thank you.
Sorry I can't give you a more definitive but it's the nature of that question.
Yes.
You know, it's a bit like a koan. Okay, how? Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Joseph, for offering your wisdom and your energy during this time. Deeply, deeply appreciate it. Thank you. So I'd like to just spend, and I apologize to the people who do have their hands up, who we didn't get to. I wanted to spend just a few minutes inviting everyone to reflect a little bit on the quality, the parami of dana. So I think everyone is probably familiar in some way with this essential quality or capacity of dana, which means generosity or freely offered giving. And it's really at the corner, at the heart of our practice. So everything we do arises or has this heart or this spirit of generosity. So many of us, all of us as teachers, received the teachings freely, wholeheartedly, even joyfully. But outside of this kind of transactional model that most of us are used to in a Western context, in which we attend a workshop or go purchase a book or something else, and we pay money and get something in return. This quality or spirit of dana is meant to offer kind of a preservation of the relationship between monks and nuns and the surrounding communities that they're a part of, and also teachers and students. So that it's meant to be a kind of right relationship or interdependence, so that centers like Seattle Insight and Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts are there, and teachers offer the teachings freely, wholeheartedly, and the community offers what they can freely, wholeheartedly, and the whole teaching is meant to continue and just continue to turn in this way. So all of our teachings here at Seattle Insight are offered freely. So that means that everything from the laptop to the chairs to the people who help support our website, to the rent that we pay for this beautiful space here, is all based on dana. So would just invite you, especially since this is a special celebratory benefit event tonight, to reflect on that, and whatever you feel moved to offer or contribute, we warmly receive. And in that way, we can all just continue to keep moving the Dharma forward together. So just invite your reflection on that. So all of that information, maybe Steve can put that on in the chat. is available on our website. We have multiple ways that you're able to offer and multiple ways that you're able to volunteer if you'd like to volunteer as a form of Dana to help support. So please just include that as part of your practice and your reflection. And we're very, very grateful for anything that you feel moved to offer. Also want to just say briefly that next weekend we're hosting a non-residential retreat. So Anushka Fernandopoulou is here next weekend. So she'll be here Friday night, and she will be here in person, so in the flesh, Friday night and also all day Saturday and Sunday. So if you'd like to come, you can register for Saturday and Sunday. You don't need to register for Friday. But please come. So Anushka is another teacher who came regularly before COVID and has generously agreed to travel and come to Seattle. And she's a wonderfully wise and also funny teacher. So I hope you'll check that out next weekend. Finally, I just want to thank our team of volunteers who helped make today possible. So there's always a whole group of people who come forward to help support, not least of which are our wonderful registrars, so Martha and Carol and others. And then here in the hall, so Adam, AV, thank you, and Lauren, Steve, Tamira, Allie, Leslie, and John, and likely a few others. So thank you all, appreciate it. And Lauren, did you have a couple things? Also should say, as Lauren is coming up here, of course, Joseph can be found at dharma.org. So, and IMS is celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. So hope you'll consider helping to continue to support IMS. So may it continue long into the future as well.
You know, I would just like to end with one little thing. May I? Since you mentioned my little poetry book.
Yes, thank you.
One of my favorite little poems. It's called Epitaph for the Living.
Oh.
May you rest in peace. Why wait till you're dead?
I think that's what they call a mic drop moment, Joseph. Perfect. I love that. And thank you for your poetry. It's just wonderful. Yeah, thank you.